Coming up, it's Counterculture with Marie Buskey. A look into the world of critical social justice, woke culture, and more on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
RCR is on a mission to revive honest media, and now you too can be an integral part of it by joining the RCR Foundation Members Club. Receive exclusive benefits only available to club members, including your own backstage pass to join the hosts for interactive behind-the-scenes discussions, along with our all-new daily curated news summary, RCR Bytes, that's delivered to your email box every morning, keeping you on the pulse of the news that matters in just a few minutes per day. To find out more, visit realitycheck.radio/members to see how you can join the mission that's making a difference.
Good morning and welcome. You are with Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio. I am your host, Marie Buskey, and this is the place where we discuss the issues through a cultural lens and how ideologies are impacting our everyday lives. If you're a regular listener, you may have noticed some subtle changes to the programming over the past few weeks. We now have great news offerings, daily weather reports, and from this week, we've also shifted and slimmed down a few shows, all in an effort to make listening and sharing easier for you. Counterculture is now going to be a two-hour, long-format interview show discussing all the topics that you know and love, with Media Matters with Marty and I moving to a standalone hour, going out live this Thursday at noon. For this week's show, I spoke with Norman Ohler. He's a German novelist, and if the name sounds familiar, he appeared recently with Joe Rogan. We will chat about how a novelist transitions to writing the best-selling non-fiction book, Blitzed, Drugs in Nazi Germany, and we'll also discuss his latest release, Tripped, Nazi Germany, the CIA, and the Dawn of the Psychedelic Age. I suspect this conversation will head down some very unexpected pathways. I then have a flashback for you from June of last year. I spoke with Incubate Debate founder James Fishback from the United States, the most articulate, insightful chap, and I wanted to share this with you again as I'm scheduled to catch up with James in the coming weeks.
You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Welcome to Kiwi Farm. Established 1840.
She just won't bloody go!
Shrieked Joey Sobrick. Joey sat perched on a hemp-covered sofa in the comfortable sty of Moonbeam. Moonbeam was Joey's co-leader of the Free Rangers and was taking time away from the politics of the farmyard to recover from chronic mastitis. She looked on, waxy-faced at a fuming Shoei. Shoei was incensed at the behaviour of Darlene Taker, a fellow free-range pig, a cunny like Moonbeam, who had all the prerequisites for party membership. She was a cunny, had a fondness for facial tattoos, and had memorised all the party slogans. But she had a dirty little secret. Darling was a darling first cunny, not a party-first pig. That went directly against the Free Rangers manifesto, because even though their name was Free Range, the reality was one of collectivism and subservience, all presided over by Shoei on her own, Moonbeam's absence.
Does she even realise how this makes us look? I swear, I can feel Winnie Ben's contempt every time I enter the farmhouse. How dare she put her own provisions before party? Ugh, Moonbeam, she even blocked the rest of the party members from a meeting. She's got to bloody go!
Shoei was gesticulating wildly, spilling her triple-shot single-origin organic oat milk latte all over the carefully curated furnishings. Moonbeam did not miss this at all. The bitching and the bickering, and that was just from Shoei. Moonbeam smiled gently.
"What support are you getting from the others in the party?"
she asked, knowing full well that this would never have happened under Shawshank. His gentle moderation was sorely missed, and the weight of co-leadership was the mantle that was heavily weighing on an increasingly hysterical Showy.
"Like who?"
squealed Showy.
Ricky just nods and yep, 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 yeps. No one sees him, let alone listens to him. Ugh, I guess that's what you get when you're a chihuahua. And Laurie Wooferry, well, he's more interested in face painting and glitter bombs than he is in the nuances of inter-party politics. Honestly, I feel like I'm carrying this all on my own.
Showy sighed and looked up at his soft-faced friend.
Oh, I better go. Thanks for the chat. Get well soon, Moonbeam. I miss you.
And with that, Showy turned on a trotter and left, and Moonbeam waved with relief as she clip-clopped down the path. Showy was caught between a literal rock and a hard place. There was an oft-never-used bylaw in the farmhouse constitution for removing animals who left their parties but refused to relinquish their seats. Problem being, the free rangers had always vocally and forcefully opposed this. And now Showy was faced with the bitter pill of succumbing to political hypocrisy or facing a very visible failure in the farmhouse day after day. She returned into the farmyard with no idea what her next move will be. Meanwhile, Darlene saw Showy leave Moonbeams and knew she would be the topic of conversation. She had no intention of leaving. Her world was falling apart. Her mate, a European pot-bellied pig, had very different ideas on pasture management and made full and free use of visiting animals to the farm, not providing them all the full benefits and provisions of those resident to Kiwi Farm. Darling was aware of her partner's proclivities, but she had a political career to pursue and now had fallen foul of the dictatorial domination and dominion of the prodigal pig herself, Showy Sarbrick. Darling had been underestimated her entire life and was not going anywhere. She was a cunny first and foremost, and if it was Utu Showy wanted, then Utu is what she'll get. Tune in next week to Kiwi Farm for the latest developments exclusively here with Counterculture on Reality Check Radio.
This is Counterculture with Marie Buskey, Wednesdays at 10 a.m. on Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome back to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie. Joining me now is New York Times bestselling author, novelist and screenwriter, including non-fiction works, Blitzed Drugs in Nazi Germany, and his latest release, Tripped Nazi Germany, the CIA and the Dawn of the Psychedelic Age. Norman Ohler, good morning and welcome to Counterculture. How are you?
Good morning. Quite good. I just woke up, so this is my first contact with reality on this day, and I'm quite happy it's with you.
Oh, thank you so much. Now, I have to ask, I had a look at your website. Your website says, I write books, some fiction, some are not. How does a German fiction writer end up writing a book about drugs in Nazi Germany? That's a bit of a leap, my friend.
It is actually. It was a very lucky and unusual leap, and it happened in 2010, so a long time ago, I guess. At the time, I was still only a novelist, and I still consider actually the novel to be the king form or queen form of writing, Königsform, we say in German. I don't know if that translates into English. I still consider writing a novel the best way to express yourself in writing. Something happened in 2010 because I was told by a friend of mine, a DJ from Berlin, the resident DJ of the Club of Visionaries, that the Nazis took all these drugs and that I should write about this. And I thought, yeah, that sounds like a great topic for the next novel, because I was sure it's just I was sure he was on drugs, just kind of making this up, because I had not heard before ever that the Nazis would take drugs. I knew quite a lot about National Socialism, because we do get educated, at least we did get educated in Germany in the 80s when I went to school. So I was pretty sure I knew most, I was pretty knowledgeable about that era, and no one had ever mentioned drugs. The opposite actually was mentioned, that the Nazis were, you know, horrible and murderers and criminals and racists and whatever. But there was also this, there was always this kind of notion that they were disciplined and that there was some kind of law and order in Germany. I was a bit skeptical about that, but it really doesn't point in the direction of drugs. I mean, it points into another direction. So when my DJ friends told me this, that the Nazis took all these drugs, I thought it's just, you know, just a crazy idea that he has for a novel of mine. So I thought, yeah, maybe that's good for a novel. But then I started researching just a little bit online, and there was not much to be found, but there was one scientific article that a German scholar for medicine history had written. And this was Dr. Peter Steinkamp, a scholar that was researching all kinds of things, medicine and history. And he published this one paper in a scientific journal claiming, it was like only two or three pages, claiming that the German army had used methamphetamine and that the victories of the German army were only due to this methamphetamine. And this was actually quite interesting to me. So I emailed this guy and he said, yeah, this is a big topic, but no one's ever written about it. But I basically don't have time to really explore it because his research area was not really that field. So we met and he told me where I could go into the archives and look at actual documents proving that the German army was basically on drugs the whole time, which is a great topic, you know. So I did go to the archives for the first time in my life. I went to an archive and I loved it there with the help of the archivists who were quite friendly in that archive. I could retrieve a lot of stuff. And then I decided to actually, yes, write a book about Nazis and drugs, write a novel about Nazis and drugs. Then I discussed this with my publisher and he also had never heard of it. And he said, actually, this is too sensitive or too important, maybe you could call it, to be put in a novel, because in a novel people might enjoy, you know, a novel is about literary style, it's about characters, it's about drama, it's not about reality really. And he said, this is about reality, we want to know what really happened, so you have to write a nonfiction book. I'm not going to publish your novel on Nazis and drugs, but I would love to publish your nonfiction book on Nazis and drugs. And I said, I'm not going to do that, really. I think nonfiction books are boring. I'd never actually read a nonfiction book. I mean, I'm really into novels. So I thought nonfiction books are, especially German historical nonfiction books, I thought they're dry and unreadable. And most of them actually are. So he said, why don't you write a great nonfiction book? One that, you know, is written in with the language that you use when you write a novel, but, you know, everything in it shall be true and shall be, you know, shall have a source, you know, so people can actually look it up. People that can actually go to the archive and look at the same documents than you. So you need like an apparatus. So I thought it's kind of an interesting, it would be an interesting experience. And I did it. And that's the book Blitzed.
And I mean, writing it in an approachable style for people, I think, is part of the success of the book. I mean, how many copies have you sold since it was released?
I actually don't know. I think between 500,000 and 1,000,000. So it's quite a big success, because my novels before sold in the thousands, which is normal for a novel in Germany. So it was really a great idea of my publisher, actually. But he also made a mistake. We'll come to the mistake a bit later on when we talk about Tripped. Mm. Let's keep in mind that that publisher really shaped my publishing agenda. It was great. It's translated into over 30 languages. And I heard that also in New Zealand, it's a popular book. So it's quite surprising. It's actually not surprising to me, because while I researched, I thought this story is so crazy that it will interest everyone. But it has been a fun ride.
Well, it also to explain so many things. Like when you look at the Blitzkrieg, day and night and day and night and day and night, you have this caravan that move across Central Europe and they never seem to take a break. And you think to yourself, how on earth do they do that in human endurance? Well, it's quite easy if you're hopped up on meth, isn't it, to sort of get from point A to point B.
I mean, this attack of Germany against the West, France and Great Britain is something that we all kind of know about, that it happened and that Germany was first, you know, having great successes. And I mean, no one really knows what actually did happen and how this was possible. And also, if you read like military history books, they kind of explain like the movement of the troops, but there's no real life to these explanations. Like you're not there. You don't understand actually what happened, especially in combination with methamphetamine, why methamphetamine was so crucial, like what the strategy really was. So I really looked at what happened. And so this Western campaign in the book is like, I don't know, 40 or 50 pages, and you're really there. And for me, that was a first time experience, and it's quite interesting. I mean, it's kind of nerdy to really understand how a military campaign works, especially when drugs are involved, but it was fun to tell this tale, actually.
Also, too, part of the German campaign was heavily based around science and experimentation at the time. So I guess when you look at it from that perspective, it's hardly surprising that they used drugs in terms of a form of warfare, you know, to actually aid their cause, which then sort of leads into when you head to Tripped, which then talks more about the development of LSD. Now, one of the things I found really fascinating with that is, of course, it was a Swiss man, is that correct, Hoffman, who was discovered LSD. Now, way back in a million years ago, my first training was actually as a pharmacy technician. One of the things we learned about was a drug that was actually just coming off market at that time, which was called ergotamine, which was used for migraines and often would be prescribed with caffeine tablets. It used to have dreadful side effects for its patients. We would sometimes get young women who'd have very bad migraines. They'd take too much of it, and then they'd have sort of really crazy, trippy dreams and all of those sorts of things. And then that's when I discovered that the basis of ergotamine was also the same basis for LSD and the work that the Swiss did on that. So sort of talk us about how you went from blitzed to tripped. So what was the mechanism between point A and point B between those two books?
When I researched blitz, I basically tried to examine everything that the Nazis did with drugs. And the two main stories are the army on methamphetamine and Hitler abusing opioids, cocaine and other drugs. So these are the two kind of pillars of blitz, but I also came across psychedelic research that the SS did in the concentration camp of Dachau. And being interested in psychedelics myself personally for many years, I thought that was quite unusual because the Nazis were not really psychedelic people. I mean, they were the opposite. They were about meth, you know, following orders, doing stuff, you know, not thinking, just doing. And psychedelics are like the opposite. So psychedelics and Nazis don't really go together at all. But why they were interested in it in the concentration camp of Dachau, they did tests on inmates because they were fascinated with the idea of developing what they call the truth drug. Nazis were all paranoid all the time. They always thought, you know, that within their own ranks, their enemies and Hitler was, you know, there were many assassination attempts on Hitler. So he was also behind this like hunt for the truth drug. You just give suspicious people a substance and then those people will, you know, reveal all their secrets. That was basically the simplistic idea of the German intelligence at the time, which was the Gestapo and the SS, basically, police force and intelligence. I thought I also have to research what was going on, really. But at the time, the archivist from the memorial of the concentration camp of Dachau, they have an own archive in that place. He said that the Americans took all the most of the SS reports on psychedelic research. I only found like one page where they hinted at the research. One page, the Americans left one page basically, but they took, you know, all the other pages. So I really wanted to find them to figure out what actually happened with that topic. And that took took another book. I couldn't fit that into Blitz because it turned out to be quite a huge story, and that's the story of Tripped. And I can tell you that story, but I don't want to.
You can go on as much as you like, because it does sound like a fascinating story. So what happened?
What happened? Many things happened. Basically, what happened, because you asked about how LSD actually originated, and that was in 1938 for the first time, the company Sandoz in Switzerland, and Switzerland was a neutral country. It didn't side with the Nazis or with the Western allies. Basically, they sided with both sides, you know, and that's a typical Swiss way of getting through the day. Their neutrality. They basically work with everyone. So what they were trying to do in 38 was develop more medicines out of ergot, because as you mentioned, ergotamine, that was their key to develop medicines. That was basically the only natural resource they used for many years, and that actually created the wealth of the company, because ergot, a fungus that grows on rye, is very poisonous, but very poisonous means it's very potent. So if you just extract the alkaloid, which is one of them is ergotamine, you can make, you know, potent medicines out of it. For example, migraine medicines. And one of the medicines they made out of it was LSD, and it's just one other, you know, thing you can make out of ergot. But they had no idea, obviously, what it was. They just created, they isolated the acid within the ergot, which is lysergic acid, and the chemist turned it into diethylamide, which is a chemical, you know, process. So he had lysergic acid diethylamide, and he wasn't sure what it was good for. He gave it to the mice, like it was usually done, animal experiment, and the animals didn't show any effects. So in 1938, LSD was basically shelved. It didn't show any potential. But then in 1943, the chemist, his name was Albert Hofmann, he looked at LSD again, which was kind of unusual, because when stuff was shelved, it was not looked at again. But he had kind of a notion that maybe this LSD is good, and maybe the mice, you know, react, you know, maybe they had an experience which men and women didn't see. So he tried it on himself, and he had a very strong experience. And then he communicated this to his boss, the CEO of Sandoz. He said, I took like a very, very small amount of this odorless and tasteless substance called LSD-25. It was the name that they gave it at the time. And I had for 10 hours the most incredible experience in my mind. You know, his body was just normal. Like, he called his doctor, and the doctor like checked his heart rate and said, I cannot detect anything. But he was like tripping on 250 micrograms of pure LSD. The walls were moving, and the colors were different. And it was a full blown LSD trip. But he had no idea what it was, you know, because it was the first one in the world. So they discussed it in the company, and they thought maybe this is a different type of medicine, a medicine that doesn't work on the body, but the medicine that works on the mind. And now the interesting thing is that the CEO communicated this finding of LSD with his best friend, and his best friend was Richard Kuhn. He was a German biochemist, and the Swiss CEO and the German biochemist had been friends since the 20s. Like, they had had the same teacher, which was a Jewish-German biochemist called Wildstätter. So these were his two master students, Kuhn the German and Stoll the Swiss. And they had always exchanged their findings from early on, and they were still exchanging the findings in the 40s, even though Richard Kuhn was by now Hitler's leading biochemist, had actually received the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. So he was quite a good chemist. And when he heard that in Switzerland, which was just like 150 kilometers away, this odorless and tasteless, extremely potent substance that changes the mind had been developed or found, he became very interested in it, because he was working on the truth drug at the time. So he actually asked the Swiss company to get his hands on ergotamine. And he received it. I found a letter that where he thanks the Swiss CEO. I found this in the archives of Sandoz in Basel. It's actually quite hard to find, but at one point I had this letter in my hand where the Nazi thanks the neutral Swiss guy for receiving all this ergotamine, which he then could easily turn into LSD in one simple step in his lab in Heidelberg. So that is interesting because that is kind of the smoking gun or the paper trail showing that the Nazis had knowledge of LSD. And we're not only using mescaline in the concentration camp of Dachau, but you know, also another odorless and tasteless substance, which is much more potent and which is much better to give unwittingly to people because mescaline has a bitter taste. So the Nazis became quite interested in LSD. They thought maybe this is it. This is the truth drug. With LSD, we can detect any traitors or enemies. So they started continued their research in Dachau, and then the Americans came only like about 1.5 years later. They liberated Dachau, found the SS reports on the psychedelic research, and then in their turn became very interested in LSD. First the American military, which immediately was confronted with a new war, the Cold War, with the Soviet Union, where also a truth drug might be quite helpful. And that's how basically the LSD came into the focus of the American military and then the American intelligence service, CIA. And that was first the Nazis, then the American intelligence service became interested in CIA, in LSD. That was really bad start for LSD as a potential medicine, because these organs were interested in LSD not as a medicine but as a potential weapon.
Did I read that Hoffman, right at the beginning, once he experimented on himself and he had that insane trip, but then realized that it was such a strong psychotropic drug that there could have been medical applications at the time that they wanted to develop, but he never had the ability to be able to do that, so it just got sort of siphoned off into military history, as it were.
LSD became like a project for Sandoz, which was they were very optimistic with LSD in the beginning. Also, they didn't know, I mean, the Swiss CEO sends samples to the Nazi biochemist, but still, you know, the company doesn't officially, you know that or is not reacting to that. They were trying to develop it as a medicine. The first thing they did was they created what they called an intoxication room within the company. I think it was very funny in the mid 40s in this, you know, very normal Swiss pharmaceutical company, that they had this room where employees from the company could go, you know, bookkeepers or chemists or, you know, anyone who worked there could go and taste LSD and then kind of report to a secretary. She was sitting there typing what people were saying, and everyone was raving about LSD. They all loved it. It was an unusual thing, you know, to take this and suddenly you see the sky. They looked out the window and they saw how beautiful the clouds were, and they looked around the room and they looked at a flower and they were like just totally amazed by what happened with them. And I quote a lot of these reports in Tripped, and they're quite funny to read. So these normal Swiss people suddenly had a revelation that life is, you know, amazing and that they're part of the universe and all that stuff that we still have when we take LSD today. So Sandoz thought that maybe this is great. This is like a mood enhancer. This like maybe could cure people's traumas and depression, because this was a very traumatic and depressive time. You know, it was World War II. Towards the end, many people were injured and had trauma and were depressed and had no, you know, didn't know how to continue living in this totally destroyed Europe. And then the company tested it also on mentally challenged people, like people with depression or mostly people with depression, actually, in a Zurich hospital. And also these people reacted very positively, like they were cured from their depression through LSD. So Sandoz thought they have like a big hit on their hands. because it was a very successful company to begin with. And they thought if they now expand into the psychedelic sphere, which was totally unknown at the time, they could like become, you know, the global leaders of psychedelic medicines. And they tried to do that. But then at the time, like in the early 50s, when they were really trying to develop LSD as a medicine, that's when the interest of the CIA in LSD peaked. And there was a meeting with the CEO of Sandoz in Basel and the head of the MK Ultra program, which was the program within the CIA to develop LSD as a mind control drug. And basically, the Americans put pressure on the Swiss. They said, we're not going to allow LSD to be developed without our notice. Like, we must be in the loop of everything, because they were afraid, the Americans, that, for example, Sandoz would sell LSD also to the Soviet Union, and maybe the Soviet Union would develop a truth drug out of LSD before the Americans did. So Sandoz was not free anymore with its LSD development. Basically, the CIA said, if you don't listen to us now, we and our friends from the FDA will, you know, make it very hard for you in general to put any medicines on the market. So the Swiss CEO basically gave in to this pressure. From that moment on, the CIA was in the driving seat of what would happen with LSD, and they had very different ideas, obviously, than the pharmaceutical company.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I found really interesting was that patents and the whole drug development is huge, because that is the period of time that you have to cash in on whatever development that you made. And with LSD, it was patented in 1948 and the patent expired in 1965. Now, it's only a very short hop, skip and a jump to 1968, which is when LSD burst into the cultural scene in the United States. So what did you find out about that period of time? You know, the CIA would have been busy working away on their truth serum. So what sort of happened in that period of time that saw LSD slip out from the secret truth serum drug into this burgeoning psychedelic youth culture?
While the CIA was happily working along with their LSD research, which was actually unethical criminal research, because they did a lot of human experiments in the United States on American citizens without telling them. They also did experiments with their own colleagues. Like in the morning in the CIA office, you would get like a drop of LSD in your coffee without anyone telling you, and then they would see how colleagues reacted. So that whole CIA mind control MK Ultra LSD research is very problematic. And basically, it didn't lead anywhere. I mean, they found out that you could severely distract someone with LSD. You could, you know, crush someone's ego. You could basically hurt someone with LSD because it is such a powerful mind drug. And if you don't know that, you've just taken it and suddenly you have totally different thoughts and perceptions, you might think you go crazy. And then, you know, that in that respect, LSD might work, but they were never able to really turn it into this magic key with which you can unlock, you know, the secrets of someone else, or you could program someone. Like the Manchurian Candidate they were never able to do that. And while they were doing their unsuccessful, unethical research, there was also still the normal research going on by brain scientists and neuroscientists and people that were interested in human consciousness, trying to use LSD as a tool to understand more about our mind. So there was a lot of research on LSD. Like there were thousands of research papers, but it takes, you know, it does take years and years to develop an actual medicine out of it. So before the normal, the ethical, the scientific research was able to, you know, make a medicine, a product out of LSD, it became illegal. And why did it become illegal? I mean, it's kind of a, funny is the wrong word, but it's kind of ironic that the CIA did also tests with individuals that then kind of turned the experience around. One of the guinea pigs that they used, for example, and they used many, many, many guinea pigs, but one of them was Ken Kesey, who had been a writer an aspiring writer, and he took he received $75 from the CIA to take LSD. He took part in a experiment in Menlo Park in California, and he had the idea that LSD, you know, he had a great trip. He had the idea for his novel One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and he realized a lot of things on LSD, and he then became one of the LSD prophets, basically. After his big success with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, he decided not to write anymore, but just to buy a bus and paint it and drive around the bus with his friends through the United States and just distribute as much LSD as he could. And he's just one example of how the LSD kind of spilled from the CIA into the counterculture. That's why John Lennon at one point said, we have to thank the CIA for giving us LSD. I mean, it could have also spilled from the regular research into the counterculture, but the regular research was at universities, like in labs. Like it wasn't out there like the CIA research. Like the CIA, they really opened Pandora's box, and LSD, which was this obscure, you know, chemical, you know, no one thought that it would become the most popular drug in the world. But because it's such a great drug, it's such a great substance, or at least many people in the 60s perceived it as such a fun and insightful and spiritual experience, it became, you know, word of mouth was spreading, and it became, you know, very popular. And at one point it was so popular that within the growing peace movement against the Vietnam War, LSD was like the drug of choice. A lot of people were using it. Then the first, you know, illegal LSD chemists popped up and mass produced LSD. It's also something that you can, it's not easy to make it, but you can make it if you're a good chemist. And one chemist can make like millions of dosages, basically, because you only need like small amounts. So LSD really went out of control, you could say, because of the strange handling it had received in the United States. The American government, in order to have something in their hands against the peace movement, then decided to schedule LSD and put LSD into Schedule 1. Schedule 1 is that category in the U.S. where dangerous drugs like cocaine and methamphetamine, then Schedule 1 or fentanyl or then Schedule 1 because they have no medicinal value. They're just dangerous and make you addicted. So LSD really landed in the wrong category because it's, you know, it has a lot of medicinal potential. But the American government is the American government.
The CIA then seeded. So they then seeded LSD out into the wider culture. Yeah. So what to what end do you think? Did your research unearth that? Why were they wanting to get this out so it could be distributed amongst this youth culture? Was this part of a grand experiment?
No,
they didn't want that. So how did it get out?
Well, they gave people LSD that was part of MKUltra, that people were given LSD. And then they were, you know, observed how they would react. And, you know, that was part of the mind control research. And then some people, you know, basically took it like Ken Kesey, just, you know, they just took it.
Because there had to have been a chemist somewhere that was able to replicate it, to distribute it outside of governmental control.
I mean, the first one that did it was Owsley III is his name. He was the son of a Kentucky governor, and he was or the grandson, I'm not sure, but he was like a Southern American guy, and he was interested in chemistry, and his girlfriend was a chemist. So he was able to make LSD. Basically, he said, I just borrowed books from a public library, and together with my girlfriend, we were able to make LSD. And then he started distributing it illegally, and people loved it. That's basically how it started. And then one of the early LSD chemists, Owsley was the first, and then there was another kind of generation, which was like, I think, three or four guys, and one of them, his nickname was the Bear, and the Bear was also the sound engineer for the Grateful Dead, and his idea was to use the concerts of the Grateful Dead as as marketplaces, you know, distribute and sell LSD there. And so that's how it spread. So the CIA made it kind of public unwillingly, and people really expanded on it.
So then it gets landed into Schedule 1 and right. becomes illegal. So, and that is in an effort to shut down this burgeoning beatnik peace movement. So the unaffected consequence of that, as you said, so does all the research then shut down on this drug? As you said, there were benefits, there were research projects going, and I guess the stigmatization then started.
Yeah, I mean, the main problem really is that by making LSD illegal, also the research became illegal, and scientists had to suddenly stop, you know, and they couldn't get their hands on LSD anymore, because in a university you can't just buy LSD from the black market and continue your research. I mean, you could, but it would be a criminal activity, and scientists usually don't engage in criminal activity, so they had to stop.
And with the patent dropping in 1965, there was no financial incentive for anybody to lobby to have further research done, because there would be no money to be made.
I mean, Sandoz, I think they could have behaved maybe differently, because they immediately also stopped distributing LSD in other countries, even though it was still legal in other countries. So Sandoz was really on the side of the American government in a way. Maybe they received pressure again in 65 when it was made illegal to not even distribute it into other countries. But this, I mean, they certainly didn't. So that was a really heavy blow to LSD. And then came the media campaign against LSD, which was also fueled by the Americans, by the CIA. I mean, the CIA had a specific program to influence mainstream media. And they influenced mainstream media by, you know, telling them, and they told the world how dangerous LSD is, which is, you know, completely unfounded. Like scientifically, it's not true that you could, you know, have, you know, whatever, you know, all kinds of diseases if you take LSD. Your brain, you know, wouldn't be healthy for your brain. The opposite is actually true. We find out now. So really, research into very, very promising medicines was stopped then and only picked up again basically in 2015 when a professor at Johns Hopkins University, Professor Griffith, could show that psilocybin, which is like a cousin of LSD, can cure very severe depression, treatment-resistant depression, I think it's called. That's when slowly the doors opened again for psychedelic research. And some other researchers, I met one researcher in Switzerland who was able in the early 90s already to do some LSD research, because Switzerland actually being the home of LSD and not having signed all the treaties within the United Nations, which outlaw, you know, the substances. In Switzerland, there was a little bit and is a little bit more freedom. So he already started in the mid-90s, but basically we lost half a century of research into things that could cure us from dementia, for example.
Yeah, my husband's a retired doctor, and I said to him, I was talking to you, and this was the topic. And he said, you know, there's been a lot of work with psilocybin, also too with post-traumatic stress disorder for people that are suffering with that. They've started studies there. And he said also with LSD, they did start around with addictions. He said there was something in the dopamine receptors in the brain to help people who were suffering from chronic addiction. So there is work that can be done, but it's that whole stigmatization of the drug still being illegal in most places that make it very, very difficult for any further work to conclude.
And it's totally absurd, because LSD does help with addiction from like opioids and alcohol. So like to have these drugs legal and to make LSD illegal is like, it just doesn't make sense. You know, it doesn't make sense at all.
When you were doing your research, both for Blitzed and now for Tripped, and you saw how governments and movements reacted in that time for the programs that they were rolling out, Did you have that moment of that clarity where history can actually teach you for things that are going on today? Did you see things and you thought, wow, they did that then and we're now seeing that rolled out now with other things? Or did you ever have that kind of moment?
You mean with psychedelic research?
Well, not necessarily psychedelic, but in terms of how attitudes towards either other drugs or even things like current pharmaceuticals with the pandemic, you know, all of those sorts of things, the use of media and propaganda and whether something is marketed as a hero or a demon, those sorts of things. Did you see any parallels from what happened in the 40s, 50s and 60s, what has been currently happening?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically the same thing. I mean, we still have the war on drugs. I just think, I mean, even then, you know, it doesn't make sense in a democratic society that the government tells you, now we're going to put up a chemical wall in your brain and you cannot, you know, go to the other side. It just doesn't make sense in democratic societies. And that tendency has only, you know, gotten worse. I mean, slowly now it's opening, which does make me a little bit optimistic that we're changing our mind in that. So there's a little bit of progress now. And if you look at, I think Australia now allowed psilocybin in treatments, and Switzerland also allows more and more. And an American company realized through clinical studies that LSD in microdosages might help against Alzheimer. And that is actually what I want to talk about to you now. That was for me personally very interesting because my mother suffers from Alzheimer. And when I read the scientific paper, I discussed this with my father, who takes care of my mother, and he said he has no medicines available to give to her. And he's a former judge in Germany, so he's not a drug person really. And he said, so why, if this is helpful, why can't I get it in the pharmacy? That's basically the research that I did for Tripp. That's why Tripp in the beginning was called LSD for Mom, because that was my incentive to research LSD, to figure out, can it really help against dementia? Can it really help my own mother? That same publisher that once told me to make a nonfiction book out of Blitz then told me LSD for Mom is not a good title and it should be called Tripped, which I think is a big mistake. I think LSD for Mom is a much better title because it really expresses the emotional urgency that I had writing this book. And after I presented my father all my research on LSD, we discussed it. He said, "Yeah, let's talk with your mom. Let's talk with my wife." And she consented. She said, "Yeah, let's try it." And then, you know, he gave her and still gives her small dosages of LSD once in a while, not every day because you shouldn't give a drug every day, basically. Any drug you shouldn't give chronically, or it could be a problem because, you know, tolerance builds. But once in a while, she receives a drop in her coffee. Her cognitive abilities are improved for that day. Her mood is improved. She can talk much better with us than if she's not on LSD. So it seems like that white paper of that company claiming that the very same receptors that Alzheimer kills are being revived or stimulated through LSD. It seems that this is actually working in our family. That's why this book, Tripped, aka LSD for Mom, is kind of an optimistic book too, and has become a very personal project for me, actually.
How is she doing?
I mean, you cannot say that LSD cures Alzheimer because the disease continues to spread in her brain, I would guess, would be the right description. But my father's convinced that it slows it down. He was actually on German TV telling you know, about his experiences. It's good. I totally believe that LSD is good against dementia, because what is scientifically also proven is that LSD and psilocybin and other psychedelic compounds reduce what is called neuroinflammation of the brain. So our brain, you know, is in a certain, you know, state, and it can be inflamed. I don't know if that's the right word in English.
Inflamed.
And that is the key, huh? Inflamed.
Inflamed.
It can be inflamed. And, you know, you wouldn't notice if your brain is inflamed. It has to do with your nutrition and all kinds of things. And an inflamed brain is more likely to develop dementia. That's one of the chief causes for dementia, is inflammation of the brain. And psychedelic compounds work against inflammation. So I think that it's really healthy, actually, to take psychedelic compounds. If you know what you're doing, and if you get, you know, if you have the right material, I think it's really healthy. I think LSD is actually a brain food in low dosages, especially. So my perception on the psychedelic compounds really changed during the research of TRIPT.
And it will be interesting to see how these things progress, because I know that people have moved on in terms of medical marijuana. There was a time that, you know, you would have to source those things, cannabis oils and the like, illegally in order to help particularly cancer patients. And now the research has been done, the work has been done, and you're able to get that prescribed for people who have a variety of conditions. So fingers crossed the same may happen for LSD for those that need it. In terms of the next steps, now that you've got the taste for nonfiction books, what's next in the pipeline, Norman?
I have become very interested in how drugs shape our history or shape kind of who we are. So I want to engage in a broader overview of this topic for my next book. Look at different periods of history and kind of look at the question of, are we only humans because we consume psychoactive compounds? Like, how old is this, and what cultural developments can we link to psychoactive compounds? Because I do think that we need a completely different understanding of psychoactive compounds. They're not our enemies. Some of them are so potent, so they might be, you know, they're dangerous that come with them. But basically, if we have a different approach to them, if we understand that they're basically our friends if we use them correctly, and our long-term companions, I think that would be an important step to go forward. I think we need a complete change in our attitude and viewpoint, and a complete legal change, obviously, also. So I'm kind of working on that. And after that, I'll write a new novel. But first, I'm going to write one more nonfiction book on this topic, because I think it's highly interesting.
Well, I know Bram Hancock. He wrote Ancient Apocalypse. That was something that he came across when he was looking for this advanced civilization. He hypothesized that there was a civilization that existed in culture around about 13,000 years BC. Sort of somewhere in there, about 12,000-ish years. And there's a lot of evidence across multiple continents of a society that is quite advanced, had technology beyond its time. It seems to have disappeared. And it also, he's researched and he believes that there may have been some form of celestial type event that created a mass extinction for this group of, this society, the civilization. And one of the areas that he's researched is the use, particularly in South America and other places, where they wonder the use of things like ayahuasca and the like for these naturally occurring psychotropic compounds helped these civilizations to obtain greater levels of knowledge that was available from a technological point at that time.
Yeah, I mean, these topics are highly interesting. So
Yeah, well, it sounds
after Blip and Tripped, I'll go for a third one. That will be then the trilogy.
Then you're done.
Yeah, then I'm done. Yeah.
Oh, then you're done.
And I just write novels and invent stuff, which is also great.
Oh, no, that sounds fantastic. One last question that I've got, and it comes out of your bio, and it's a completely different pivot, but I have to ask. You were a resident writer in residence in Ramallah back in the day, and the last person to interview Yasser Arafat. What was that like? What was he like?
That was actually a very funny meeting, because I was quite stoned, because I didn't know that meeting would take place, and I was bored in my apartment in Ramallah, and I ate a hash cookie that I had with me. Basically out of boredom, I wanted to get inspired, so I ate this hash cookie, and suddenly I get a call that I would meet Arafat in like 30 minutes, and I was really high, actually, and a car pulled up outside my apartment. I mean, I was like poet laureate of Ramallah for a time through the German Cultural Institute, so my job was to write about the daily life of the Palestinians, And I really wanted to meet Arafat, but it was very difficult, obviously. But suddenly someone made it possible, and I got this call, and I got into this car, and the car drove to the Mukata, which was his half-destroyed compound in Ramallah, where he was residing would be the wrong word, basically living in his uniform. And I was led through like a maze of hallways, and suddenly I was in a room, and he was actually sitting there. And he looked like a space alien, basically, which he looked like a completely different entity. He was quite very, very small. And he approached me in his uniform with this thing on his head. Like, he really looked iconic. And then we had a very lovely lunch together, just him and me, for like 2 hours. And it was quite a memorable experience, the talks we had. And 3 weeks later, he was dead, which completely surprised me, because when I met him, he didn't seem ill. I mean, he was shaking. So I guess he had maybe Parkinson's, or he was old also. So he was not completely healthy, but his mind was, he was good, basically. So that was it. And now I guess we all need Arafat, but he's not there anymore.
Mm. Yeah, it's also, we've just lost our Māori king here, which is quite a big figure very suddenly. And yeah, you don't always know when that last conversation will be. So I guess that's certainly something to address. Yeah.
I think I was the last European to speak to him, because after that he was, he died. So yeah. It was interesting.
Well, there you go. Well, look, it's been absolutely fascinating this morning, Norman. I really do appreciate your time. Where can people find the books if they're wanting to purchase them? I know Blitzed, I've definitely seen Blitzed, the local bookstore at the end of my street, so that's definitely widely available. Is Tripped now available and out for people to purchase?
Yeah, absolutely. I received a link recently that it's in the independent bookshop's best-selling list in your country.
Excellent.
So I would imagine that bookshops would have it, and of course I would encourage you to go to your local bookshop, and if they don't have it, I guess they could order it for you, so you would have it the next day. And if that doesn't work out, just go to any big online shop, but you can get it.
That's wonderful. This has been Norman Ohler. He is the New York best-selling author of, as we said, Blitz, Drugs in Nazi Germany, and then Tripped, Nazi Germany, the CIA, and the Dawn of the Psychedelic Age. So make sure you check those out. And what have we got, a working title for the third one?
Yeah, but I can't reveal it yet.
Oh, okay. There you go. Too good.
Okay. We talk about it next time.
Okay. There we go. There's always the next time. Hey, look, I appreciate your time this morning. Don't disappear, everybody. Still on the shorter show today, coming up is a flashback from James Fishbeck, the founder of Incubate Debate, and the conversation that him and I had last year in preparation for me chatting to him in a couple of weeks. So don't disappear. It's up here next on Counterculture with Reality Check Radio.
You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Now it is time for a Counterculture flashback. We're heading back to June last year when I chatted with James Fishbeck from Incubate Debate on the infiltration of critical theory and social justice into the competitive debate scene. I will be catching up with James again in the coming weeks to see how things in the world of debate are and life in the USA ahead of November's election. But in the meantime, enjoy this RCR flashback. You with Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio. I am Marie, and my guest is James Fishbeck from Incubate Debate in the United States. James, good morning and welcome to Reality Check Radio.
Well, good morning. Thank you for having me.
I am really excited. I got sent an article that you wrote a few weeks ago in the Free Press, and it put my spidey senses up. And the friend that sent it to me said, oh, you're going to love this. And it is titled The High School Debates. Debate is no longer allowed. So give us an idea of what is in the article and what prompted you to write it.
Absolutely. What's the article details is how high school debate went from an activity that elevated objectivity and merit and free speech into an echo chamber where certain viewpoints are censored and free speech is under attack. And the article is really centered around the National Speech and Debate Association, which is the oldest debate league in the country, in the United States, as well as the most influential. And the way the article is really developed is around something called a judge paradigm. So these are essentially online blog posts that judges, the high school debate judges, submit to the tournaments. And they were originally designed so students could read their judges' criteria expectations before the debate and adapt accordingly. So the way it might work is if a judge had a preference for students to not speak a mile a minute and to slow down, by reading a judge's paradigm, the student would know, hey, I've got to slow down a little bit. The judge isn't on the spreading or the 300 word per minute bandwagon. If the judge said, hey, I prefer you structure your evidence this way, or I'd prefer you spend a lot more times on your impact, which is why your argument matters, then the student would adapt accordingly. Now, that's all fine and good. These judge paradigms, when they are used to relay information around style and speed, that's perfectly fine. But what's happened over the last couple of years is these paradigms have been hijacked. They're now riddled with political and ideological statements that in effect tell students what they can and can't say and how they can and can't say it. So the article starts off with this example from the 2019 National College Debate Champion here in the United States. She is a regular on the high school debate scene. And she tells students before they even begin debating in front of her, she tells them, quote, before anything else, including being a debate judge, I am a Marxist, Leninist, Maoist. I will no longer evaluate and thus ever vote for arguments which include capitalism good, imperialist war good, neoliberalism good, defense of the U.S. or nationalism good, normalizing Israel colonialism, U.S. white fascist policing good. So how does that young American sophomore feel when she walks into a debate round and she has an argument about how capitalism is the best way to protect the individual liberties of the people, or how it breeds innovation and growth? And so it really tilts the scale against this free and open dialogue that high school debate was all about. It changed my life. I did debate for 4 years in high school. I was a debate coach for 2 years afterward. This activity has tremendous potential, but it's under attack by individuals who are now using it as more of a Trojan horse. On the outside, it appears to be this vehicle for free speech, open expression, diversity of thought, but it's yet another tool that's used by the diversity, equity, and inclusion crowd to censor, to attack free speech, and to push an agenda where only one side is truly righteous.
Surely within the paradigms for these judges, this must go against the charter of the national body.
It does. It absolutely does. In fact, the charter says, and I quote, judges should decide the round as it's debated, not based on their personal beliefs. But as you know, it's not necessarily what the rules say. It's are the rules enforced? And there's no question that this judge and the many others like her that I've outlined in my piece and the hundreds of other paradigms that didn't get to make it in the piece but are egregious, they blatantly violate the rules of high school debate. But it's one thing to violate the rules. It's another thing to be enforced, to have those rules enforced against you. And it seems that the National Speech Debate Association has no interest in enforcing these rules, in large part because it's a feature, not a bug, of how they operate. They are perfectly fine with censoring conservative or even right of center, even centrist arguments, as long as it saves their students the awkward conversations about what happened during the pandemic with the lockdowns, what happened with the vaccine mandates, what happened around childhood education as a result of the lies that we were told, what's happening at the southern border, what's happening, the truth about the Second Amendment or President Trump's foreign policy. So in an attempt to save kids from the emotional volatility of having to come to terms with the actual facts of those issues, they instead allow this tacit censorship that keeps everything hunky-dory and stable.
Mm. When did the rot start setting in?
You know, I barely noticed, and I'd really have to reach to go back to my time as a high school debater, which was 2009 to 2013. I'll tell you, I had a blast. I had an awful childhood stutter as a kid, and debate gave me that opportunity to fix it. you know, when you're giving speeches every weekend, when you're practicing to give those speeches every single day, it really does help with that. I remember as a high school freshman reading Milton Friedman, reading The Economist magazine, reading what was happening in countries that 6 months prior, I had no idea where to find on a map. So it was truly an eye-opening experience. But when I left in 2013 and then I returned in 2017, the debate scene that I came back to, I hardly recognized. This thing that transformed my life had transformed into something that was a shell of its former self. If I had to guess, I would say it had something to do with a certain man coming down a certain escalator in the summer of 2015. And whether you support his policies or not, there's no doubting that when Donald Trump entered the race and then became president of the United States, it created this tribalism. And the tribalism said, are you with us or are you against us? Because our side is the only side that's truly right and just. And I think in their mind, those who are censoring in the high school debate scene, they view this as righteous because they view the other side as rooted in fear, paranoia, racism, xenophobia, nationalism. And I'll tell you, they wouldn't have that view if both sides had an equal opportunity to debate. They would see that the conservative viewpoint is really about putting the citizens of a country first. It's about individual liberty. It's about self-defense. It is about economic liberty. And it's a shame that they can't see that and they are talked into this tribalistic political nature. And that's in large part because they've censored the other side, who doesn't have a chance to convince them otherwise.
I mentioned to you before we got started, I was an exchange student in the US in the late 80s. And so I'm very aware of this debate scene. So it's something that here in New Zealand isn't very prevalent. But what I remember going to the debates, I used to go and watch the debates that our school competed in. What I loved seeing was how you would have students that were at one school who, because of the environment that the school was in, would have leanings and opinions in one form, were pitched against quite a different school, and the moot was opposite. They had to argue opposite of what you would normally expect. And watching what would unfold, and you could see that students would then often have to argue something that normally they would personally be against, but they've had to research and watch that unflowering. So the school I was at was based off an Air Force base, so it was a very pro-military. 80% of the students there were the students of military personnel, bearing in mind late 80s. So then when they were given a moot that was, do you believe that American intervention is required in, and I think it was Panama was the topic, and watching right. These kids who were all really pro that, having to then think, well, okay, let's think about the other side of the story and vice versa. Yeah, and that is the value, isn't it? It's creating kids to become critical thinkers.
It absolutely is. And critical thinking is at its heart being able to put yourself in other people's shoes and see different perspectives. If you just see a certain party as representing evil, then you don't have the perspective to see, well, what is actually driving this, that, and the other. I'm reminded of a debate that when I was a debate coach, my students participated in about police funding. And I coached an all-Black team when I came back to be a debate coach in 2017. And the idea at the time was that Black people were all against the police. And white students and Asian students had this idea that if you're Black, that you are anti-police. And it wasn't until they competed alongside Black students who were actually pro-police that they actually got to see, wait, there's something out there. The media is telling us one thing. Popular culture is telling us one thing. But sitting across the table and talking to people who look different from you, have come from a different background, and can kind of turn the narrative, that's profound. That is profound. That's how you bring a people and a country together. I'm reminded we have a presidential candidate here in the United States on the Republican side, Vivek Ramaswamy, who talks a lot about free speech and open debate. And he says this often. He says, the path to conviction, the path to unity is through free speech and open debate. Imagine the conversations around the pandemic, around the lockdowns, around education, not just in the United States, but in New Zealand. The censorship that took place around those conversations. You weren't allowed to question certain things. Had the people, the free people of New Zealand and the United States, been able to question and to really earnestly push back against this narrative, the pandemic, the response would have looked very, very different. We would not have been stripped of our liberties. We would not have been locked down in the ways that we were had we been able to have an equal dialogue with the other side and not be deemed fake news or disinformation, misinformation. And so that the heart of open debate is much bigger than high school debate. This piece and what's happened in high school debate is really a reflection of what's happening in advanced countries around the world. The ruling elite finds certain ideas unacceptable, labels them dis and misinformation, and then keeps them out of the public square in order to, in their words, protect the people, protect safety. And the best way to beat speech that you disagree with is to have better speech and to convince otherwise.
And the other thing too is I think more speech.
Yeah, more speech.
More speech. You get to a point, and we've certainly seen it in this country, you get to a point where you are shouted down and demonized so much for having a contrary opinion for what is set out by the ruling classes that you just get to a point where it just gets too hard and you just want to keep your head down and don't want to say anything. You're coming into primary season. So, I mean, there are announcements left, right and centre now for political candidates and the brouhaha is already beginning to start. Are those conversations also starting or is it as divisive as ever?
I think it's as divisive as ever. One statistic that really exemplifies this, especially for young Americans, where the division is the most stark, is if you ask young Democrats, would you date a Republican? One third of Democrats say no. No, I would never date a Republican. And if you flip it, if you ask young Republicans whether they would date a Democrat, it's only 5% who would say no. Look, there's division on both sides, but it seems like the unwillingness to even have that conversation is really coming from the left. I think they've been told a lot of lies, and I don't blame them, right? I look at everything that's been said over the last couple of years, right? We were told for years that President Trump was an agent of the Kremlin, was compromised by Russia. And so when anybody on the right would support him, they were mocked by the left as being someone carrying water for Putin, someone who was a Russian double agent as well. So that statistic really, really tells a story that the division is not just about not willing to have a conversation about politics. It is not willing to engage them even over a drink, even over something more than that. So I look at that and say, you know, when I was growing up, when you spent your time here in the US in the late 80s, we didn't care who was a Republican or a Democrat. We didn't care. Okay, you voted for Clinton, you voted for Bush, you voted for Reagan, you know, you voted for Carter. But we were all American. We were all American. We all believed in the ideas that set this nation into motion nearly 250 years ago. Merit, free speech, diversity of thought. And to see young people scorn at the other side and to label them in such a way, you can never get unity unless you have honest conversation. And for a lot of people, by the way, that honest conversation would happen at these debate tournaments. Those kids, even if they weren't in debate, they would take that message, that empathy, that ability to listen twice as much as we speak, right? We have two ears, one mouth. That ability, that willingness to listen and speak with the other side, they would take that back to school and they would instill those values in others. And unfortunately, we're not seeing that right now.
I'm talking to James Fishbeck, the founder of Incubate Debate. I'm glad you brought up patriotism, because that was the one thing that struck me as a student, is the level of patriotism. That was the one thread that pulled people from both sides of the political aisle together. You all bleed red. It was you, America first. And it was, as a Kiwi, we don't have that level of patriotism quite the same, not as to the forefront as you had in the US. And it's actually, it is quite infectious. I found it really, really infectious. One of the things as an observer now looking back to the US, particularly in the last 5 years, is a determination to erode that patriotism and dismantle it. Are you sensing that, seeing it?
I'm seeing it 100%. I'm seeing it 100%. You need to look no further than the New York Times editorial board member, Mara Gay, when she said a couple years ago, I was out on Long Island, I saw so many American flags, and it was repulsive. It was, right, the idea that all of these American flags, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, if you hang an American flag, if you hung an American flag on your deck, you couldn't guess someone's political affiliation. You couldn't guess who they voted for in the last election. Now the American flag has become this symbol of the right, not because the right has made it a symbol. They've always believed that it's been a symbol, like any American, but it's because the other side has now viewed the American flag as somehow symbolizing xenophobia and nationalism, what they pejoratively call America First, what we proudly call America First. So patriotism has now been weaponized against people. The idea that it's somehow you're proud to not stand for the flag, that you don't have the American flag, if someone gets mocked for having the flag on their car or on their lapel pin, as somehow being jingoistic or being some sort of nationalist. And that's awful. We need to come together as a country. You saw it again in the 80s. I saw it growing up in the 90s and the early 2000s. A country where patriotism is not partisan. It is something that we all share. It transcends political party. It transcends race. That's something we have to really, really get back to, right? We have to feel like we're one country again.
It's interesting you brought up Vivek Ramaswamy, because he's someone I really want to talk to. I've read his book, White Capital, and he talks really well around the creation of social justice ideologies within capitalism and how dangerous and pernicious they can be. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, the big thing are these ESG scores, which are starting to crop up everywhere. I've been following and tracking two things that have been going on, but particularly the boycotts that are starting. People are quietly, they're getting to the point where I think no one's listening to them necessarily in the media or in other formats, so they're voting with their wallets. And that seems to be quite effective. So Anheuser-Busch obviously has been hit with this. Now I think Target has become a target. Coles, there's been a few others that people are now saying, putting their hands up and saying no. Do you think that that is actually capitalism, dare I say it, could be the savior of the day?
I think capitalism is always the savior of the day. For all the ails, the ailments that afflict us, for all the issues that we face, whether they're the people in sub-Saharan Africa, whether they are economies that are trying to move up from third world to second world, or even to the advanced economies, capitalism is the solution to everything, right? When Adam Smith penned The Wealth of Nations in 1776, of course, the same birth year as our country. I don't think that was a coincidence. We can kind of look back at that and say that's interesting. But three people using their power, using their hard-earned resources to make decisions about what values they want the companies that they support to focus on is the name of the game, right? If where was Anheuser-Busch, where was Bud Light, when we could have put Susan B. Anthony or Rosa Parks or Condoleezza Rice, right? Where were those advertisement campaigns? And then all of a sudden, we get Dylan Mulvaney on a can. Where was the Target display for Veterans Day last year or Memorial Day to honor the great men and women who paid the ultimate sacrifice to keep us all safe and to protect the values that all of us hold dear. So there's so much hypocrisy here that so many Americans, I think, are frustrated who are participating in these boycotts. They realize they actually have some power for once. And they say, look, we are not going to support businesses that don't respect our values, be it Target, be it Anheuser-Busch, be it whatever. If you put certain philosophies and ideologies on a pedestal, while ignoring the values that we 20 years ago all held sacred, patriotism, reverence for our men and women in uniform, the great female icons that made this country what it is today, then we have no reason to buy your product. And people will vote with their feet. And hopefully the businesses will look at that and kind of summed up, right? Go woke, go broke. They'll realize that the people can't take it anymore, that they don't want their products, that they don't want their money going into something that does not represent their and their family values.
Yeah, we're certainly starting to see it here too. And I think this is the beginning of a big change. The saying done in this part of the world is, if America sneezes, we catch a cold. One of the things that you mentioned before is in terms of the state of debate nationally. What I loved about looking into you was the fact that A, you're frustrated about it, B, you've spoken out about it, but C, you've done something about it. So talk me through Incubate Debate.
Absolutely. So I left the traditional high school debate scene in 2019. I'll never forget one of my students a black young man, really bright, really eloquent, being told by his judge, you know, you would have won the debate had you not condemned the Black Lives Matter organization. This was a white judge telling that to a black student. So that was kind of near where the straw broke the camel's back. And I said, look, this organization can't be reformed. Let's go back to the beauty of capitalism. Let's go back to creating parallel institutions where competition and in turn creative destruction reign true. And so I started this organization, a nonprofit here in the United States called Incubate Debate, which is as much a verb as it is a noun. We're trying to incubate debate in these middle and high school communities. So we are the fastest growing debate league in the country. We exclusively serve the state of Florida, which is the third largest state in the US. And how do we do things differently? Well, first, all of our tournaments are free, which no one else can say. Everything that we do is no cost. Second, we are serious about free speech, open debate, and merit, which means that at our tournaments, these radical judges who push their ideology, and by the way, this is not a left or a right issue. Any adult pushing their ideology on a child, that is wrong. It would be just as wrong as if conservatives were doing it, as if progressives were doing it. When a student comes into a round, they ought to win or lose that round on the merit, their evidence, their logic, their persuasion, their ability to answer questions from their opponent. Point blank, period. That's it. And then finally, and I'm most proud of this, is that we have citizen judges, which is to say the other debate leagues like the NSDA, they bring former high school debaters who are now college students, who are now studying gender studies and feminism and all of that at the Ivy League, who are really detached from reality and in turn feed this echo chamber. What we do is we bring in members from the community, citizens who actually represent the best of what makes this country so special. So law enforcement, first responders, firefighters, members of the armed forces, local elected officials, state elected officials, members of the judiciary. And oftentimes we have special guests, people like Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch or Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg or Governor Chris Christie and so on, to really open our students up, to give them all of the different viewpoints and allow that marketplace of ideas to do what it always does best, elevate the ideas that will succeed on the merit and on their logic. And what's happened as a result is students who have come in with a certain viewpoint, either two options. One, their mind is opened to different ideas and they begin to change. Or the second, and this is even just as important, is they stick with the same idea, but they end up with a much firmer conviction. I've always been pro-life. I've always been pro-life growing up in a Catholic household. But having to defend pro-life when I was a high school debater gave me even a stronger conviction in what it meant to be a pro-life American. So either you walk away with a different view, one that is rooted in evidence and logic and merit, or you walk away with the same view that you walked in with, but it now has even more evidence, logic, and merit to back it up. Beautiful conversations are happening. Kids from all backgrounds are coming together. Parents, grandparents, nieces, nephews all come to spectate our debate. These truly are laboratories of engaged citizenship and democracy. Saturdays, where kids come out and debate the Constitution, where they do historical look back debates and see, was the Vietnam War justified? Was the pandemic lockdowns, were those justified? Where we debate issues like nuclear energy, U.S. nuclear policy when it comes to weapons, the border, Second Amendment, so on and so forth. So it really is a beautiful thing. And I'll tell you, we always start our incubate debate events patriotically. We start with that Pledge of Allegiance. We start by reading the opening words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence as a subtle reminder that we are all here pledging allegiance to one country, working to solve and to better understand the issues that often ail us.
I mean, that's one of the questions I was going to bring up, was around the topics that you have. I mean, you've got you're hitting topics that even legacy media won't touch.
Right.
So right. That's saying something. I mean, I'm just looking at here in regards to should the US spend more on police? Well, they, you know, and as we well know, they've spent since 2020. Right. Defunding the police was the catch cry amongst many. Should the US send troops to Haiti? Well, there you go. That's an argument that's been going on since my day when I was there. The body positivity movement, helpful or harmful?
Right. And those are questions, by the way, to the NSDA and to the mainstream media, those questions are off limits. And the reason why is because they're viewed as settled. They're viewed as settled issues. Of course, the body positivity movement is helpful. How dare you question that, lest you be flat fat phobic, right? Of course, the pandemic lockdowns were brilliant. Of course, there were no issues with the 2020 election, right? So those are sort of settled questions. And what we do is we say, nothing is settled in the marketplace of ideas. The best ideas are always elevated because they have the best evidence and merit.
I want to pivot slightly. AI. Everyone's talking about AI. Do you think AI is going to have an effect in the debate space?
I think in one way it can, in one way it can, but it wouldn't be as beneficial. We actually had a debate recently about whether AI was going to benefit students via the K-12 teacher angle. And it was a great debate, by the way. But I think to the extent that artificial intelligence, best known today as kind of the ChatGPT, that can help students research better. It can help them test ideas out, help the AI kind of refute the ideas and say, give me a reason why this might not work or give me a way to embolden this. Students still need to do their own research and whatnot. But again, it can be a helpful tool, much like for a mathematician, a calculator can be helpful, or for a landscaper, an automatic lawnmower, machine powered, could be helpful. I think where AI becomes problematic in the debate space is if it's used to replace the human interaction. So instead of going to practice with your coach or with your team members, you instead resort to this back and forth with this chat, this AI artificial chat. And that strips the debate, that strips the humanity from debate, the human connection. One thing that's great about debate is that every weekend or so, you're meeting with people, you're hanging out, you're having pizza. You know, you have a really tough competitive round, and then afterward, you're having snacks and sharing a soda. That's the beauty of debate. It's to bring Americans from all backgrounds together to debate issues that matter, to debate topics that matter. So I would say AI as a research tool can be very helpful, but it should never replace the human interaction of testing ideas with your fellow peers.
And we all know that the lockdowns was one of the things that, by pulling people apart, it allowed so many of these regulations and restrictions to be applied because people couldn't. It's not the same. I mean, you and I are doing this over Zoom and we do it in video, so you and I can see each other. This is going out in audio, but it's not the same as the connection of actually sitting with somebody and having an organic discussion, which is
There's nothing like it. You know, if you and I have a disagreement, or we agree and we walk away and give each other a hug, we shake hands, there's powerful in that, that no amount of Zoom or no amount of 5G can ever replace.
Absolutely. So funding, you're doing this for free. So there has to be, how are you being funded with this?
Well, so we accept, you know, I've been fortunate enough because of my full-time work in the investing world to fund a lot of it, but we've also been funded by, you know, small donors here in the state of Florida, families who have deep ties to the state, who look at what's happening in the country and say, we've got to do something about it. And what better investment to make than in the future, young people having important dialogue, important conversations about the issues that are top of mind for so many Americans. And I'll say this, all of our judges come to us as a volunteer. We almost never pay for event space, almost never pay for food. All that food is donated. So we actually run a very lean and mean operation here at Incubate Debate. And what does that mean? It means that the donations that come in go directly to impacting the students. They go directly into facilitating this dialogue to ensure that both sides can be heard.
So any plans to grow from Florida?
You know, if you would have asked me a couple of weeks ago before the article came out, I would have said that was maybe a 2 to 3 year plan. But the article has been read over a million times. Hundreds of people have reached out, whether they're school board members, teachers, state representatives, business partners, and they all have one question. How can we bring Incubate Debate to our community? And so it's something we're working on right now. We have this model. And the model, by the way, is no cost, our unique formats, which are what we call easy to learn, hard to master. When you think of high school debate, you often think of this two-on-two debate where you go back and forth. It often devolves into a shouting match. Students can speak a mile a minute, but that's not the debate that happens across the dinner table. That's not the debate that happens on the patio. That's not the debate where really most Americans bridge the divide and understand each other's differences. Most of those debates, again, happen in the most unusual places where you wouldn't expect debate to happen, at the dinner table, at the water cooler, so on and so forth. So we have one format, which is unique to us. We started it. It's called Roundtable. And Roundtable is where you put eight students together for 20 minutes. And there are only three rules. The first, you can't use notes. The second, you can't stand up. And the last one is the only other rule is the rule of common decency and civility. So it's sort of like The View, except there are multiple views allowed. People get to have this open, free-form conversation. You can interject. You can ask questions. You can offer opinions. If someone says something you disagree with, you don't have to wait your turn. You can immediately refute. Now, that teaches two skills. One is the ability to think on your feet, but two is the ability to listen. Again, we have two ears, one mouth. Listen twice as much as we speak. My grandmother of 96 taught me that and still teaches me that, reminds me of that. That the best listeners, the best debaters are often the best listeners because they take it in and then they prioritize what they really, truly want to say. We want to take that model, that unique, those unique formats, this no-cost model, and then the idea of citizen judges, all of which are unique to incubate debate. We want to take that and bring it to individual communities across the country. So we are racing to do something this summer to identify 2 to 3 local partners on the ground in different parts of the US and say, we want to work with you because you and us, we both recognize the power of open debate and free speech.
Oh, that sounds so inspiring. I can't wait to also see the incubate corporate model where you go in and have debates within the corporate environment, hopefully break down some of that DEI stuff that goes on. I think that would be amazing as well. There you go. You can do that next year.
That'd be a great idea, right? Think about it. There's no better way. Yeah. You say that this is great. I say that this is bad. Let's have a debate around it. And on Bridgewater, which is the largest hedge fund in the world, they've apparently built their success on this model of debate where every idea, no idea is taken for granted, no issue is settled. Everything at any time can be up for debate. And that is the kind of rigorous standard we ought to hold ourselves to in the country, in government, in education, and especially in the corporate world.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, well, look, James, thank you so much for taking the time to join us this morning. Really appreciate it. Where can people find more information about what you're doing?
Well, they can look at incubatedebate.org, just how it sounds, incubatedebate.org. Take a look at it. Look at our topics. Look at the videos of Roundtable of young students, 14, 15-year-old, having discussions about the Second Amendment or about U.S. foreign policy. And if they like what they see, we would always appreciate their support as we continue to fight to bring free speech, merit, and diversity of viewpoints back to high school debate in America.
Thank you so much. Stay tuned, everybody. More interesting conversation and information here on Reality Check Radio with Marie. You're with Counterculture.
You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
You're with Counterculture with Marie here on Reality Check Radio, and that was 32 Flavors, a song written by renowned indie singer-songwriter Annie DeFranco, but achieved commercial success with this version by Alana Davis in 1997. Thank you to everyone who sent in feedback last week. Here's a sampling of some of your thoughts. And on the Doug Casey interview, hi Marie, great talk this morning. Interesting that the description of Kamala is the same as a description of Chloe Swarbrick would be if anyone took the time to see how inept she is. Cheers, Ross. Thanks, Ross. On the interview I did with Anne Batley-Burton, why do real estate agents insist on supporting French wine with champagne when we have the best wines in the world? I will, as much as a wine lover that I am, we have some wonderful wines here, but I have to say when it comes to champagne, there is only one champagne. So I guess it's that something a little bit extra special. You never know. French real estate agents may celebrate things with New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. Hi, Marie. I really love your show, but I have to say that the wine lady you're talking to sounds as though her answer for all of life's sorrow and finding joy is to find a glass of champagne. Sadly, many people now suffer from alcoholism because they got into the habit of reaching for a drink to solve every problem. Addictions of every kind devastate people's lives and destroy families. No joy then. Linda. Thanks for your thoughts, Linda. Hi, Marie. As much as I have sympathy with Anne Burton about her campaigner issue and going out more, we as a couple cannot afford any more to go out spending money as we used to do. Why? Guess why? Because of the big elephant in the room that no one likes to talk about. Good for her to still be able to afford going out. I know many who cannot, but to be honest, I don't mind it anymore. I rather stay at home and spend time and money with like-minded people and worthwhile causes instead of supporting a rotting economy and corrupt system. I supported businesses during the mandates, and how did they treat us? So the sooner it all goes down the googler, the sooner people will finally come together and build the new world we keep talking about. At least that's what I'm hoping for. Many thanks to you all at RCR and keep up the great work. From Mike, from Top of the South. Well, thank you, Mike. And actually, in a way, you've just described how you found your own joy, isn't it, coming together with like-minded people. As Natalie said the other day, and I think I played it as a flashback, it's that breakdown before the breakthrough. And I think you described that beautifully. Thank you. Now, if you've got any comments, even song suggestions, let me know. Text me on 2057 or email us to inbox@realitycheck.radio. Now, if you just join me and you're settling in for Media Matters, because it is that time, you can stand down. But fear not, Marty is going nowhere. We've just moved Media Matters to a standalone spot, scheduled for tomorrow at noon. One entire hour of Marie and Marty fabulousness, giving you our own take on how the media reporting of the issues of the week is going on both here and abroad. Hey, I hope you've really enjoyed the show this morning. We hope this tighter, shorter format makes it easier for you to digest content and share. If you've caught a clip or an interview that encapsulates how you're feeling, please do share it, either directly, on social media, or over a coffee with a friend. Every conversation started is a kernel of truth planted. I also want to take the time to say a huge thank you to the team behind the scenes as well, who have been putting in the hard yards, getting RCR sounding even better than ever. Those quiet warriors giving so much of themselves to make us sound good. I'll catch you all tomorrow with Marty for Media Matters, but for today, it's time for this Kiwi Immortal classic. Here's the Near the World Dancing Toys on RCR, and I'll catch you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Counterculture
with Marie Buskey
on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.